of getting the details clear, seeing that not every colored man is a nigger, not every Chinese is a chink, not every Italian is a wop, you see? Now, of course, yes, there's the richness of detail. But these are philosophical fashions that go back and forth between the prickly-minded people and the gooey-minded people. The prickly-minded people are the nominalists, and they like to emphasize the details, the atomic, discontinuous structure of things. The gooey-minded people like to emphasize the great connected generalities. The way things form into bodies. But you see very clearly what happens if you press nominalism to its logical conclusion. The answer is there are no people. There are only amalgamations of cells. What you really are these cells. Or do you want to go further? Say what you are is only these electrons. That's all there is, you see. And this idea that they add up in some way to a person is just an abstraction. You're not really there, you see. They're just all that. Now, wait a minute, Mr. Nominalist. Suddenly, you are beginning to turn into a believer in Maya. What's your step, you see? If you push anybody far enough philosophically, they all arrive at the same place. You suddenly tell me you don't believe human beings really exist. There are only these atoms. Well, well, well. So I suppose we can argue the same thing about connections in time. Melody is then an illusion. There are only the individual notes. After all, if you're going to be a nominalist, then melody is something that just doesn't exist at all. Okay. Well, that's almost what the Buddhists say. When I was explaining to you this morning, the moment, 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 and you don't connect the moments, there's only one moment, you know, this thing. Well, that's saying the same thing the same way. It's saying that all the connections are an illusion. You push your nominalist right into the corner. You say the only things that exist are the multiplicity of atoms, and actually they only exist now. See, because you can't even say it. Only this moment is real. The ultimate hairline, you see. That's why the precisionist is making watches that have hairlines narrower and narrower and narrower and narrower, so they can only be seen by amazing microscopes. Exactly. They want to know, when does that thing cross that thing? Boing. See? So eventually they're going to get down and down and down. And the universe has no time to exist in. Therefore it doesn't exist. Therefore it's an illusion. That was what bugged Zeno when he got the paradox of motion. And now either an arrow is somewhere or it isn't. If it's moving, it isn't anywhere. But it's obvious if it isn't anywhere, it couldn't exist. You know, that kind of thing. It's the same problem as Achilles and the tortoise. Manifestly, the Achilles in a race overtakes the tortoise. But you can talk about this race in such a way that he can't. Well, how do you do the trick? What you do is this. Although Achilles in the physical world overtakes the tortoise, in the intellectual world, which you are using to measure the process, you measure his approach to the tortoise by a narrower and narrower scale as he approaches the tortoise. Although he runs right by it, your measuring process gets more and more minute. You take longer and longer to think about it because you're counting more units, so that you can indefinitely subdivide the distances he is passing in his approach to the tortoise. And you can go on talking about their subdivisions forever, so that in terms of your talking, he never gets by the tortoise. Because you're drawing the lines finer and finer and finer and finer and finer. So now who's making the abstractions? The nominalist was telling the realist, you're making the abstractions. You're talking about these vast generalities called humanity and America. But now who's making the abstractions? I thought you were the prickly fellow who was so precise and said only these specific, particular details exist. Da, 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 da. You see? But he disappears into abstraction. So the pot calls the kettle black. So you see, that fight goes out the window. Because they both, if you push them far enough, they come back to each other. Push a realist far enough and he comes into a nominalist. Push a nominalist far enough and he turns into a realist. What does that mean? Well, it means the same thing as if you investigate matter thoroughly, you turn up with mind. If you investigate mind thoroughly, you turn up with matter. If you investigate yourself, what do you mean by you? How do you know you exist? In terms of what? What do you discover if you push that? Why, you discover everything else that you thought wasn't you. You only know you exist because you've got things to feel and other people to talk to, and because you go yah yah yah, you reflect the external world. So investigate you and you get the external world. Now what happens if you investigate the external world? Well, you get you. That's what happens, you see, when finally the physicists wanted to know, how are things like when we're not looking at them? That's the great question, you see. In order to see how electrons behave, I've got to put them in a process which influences their behavior. I'm really bombarding electrons with electrons. Now, what is the electron doing when I'm not looking at it? See, does the light really go off in the refrigerator when you close the door? So you find, you see, that knowing, the act of knowing, changes what you are knowing. Knowledge of something is the same as action upon it. You do not know that a ball is rubber until you bounce it. And that acts upon the ball. And that's so with everything. All knowing is not something you merely are a passive spectator. All knowing is the result of experiments on things. Only in the most trivial instances are you ever, and even then if you go into the neurology of it, the electronics of it, you're not a passive spectator. You may just observe things and write them down. Although when you do, it's pretty trivial. The really good knowledge is always accumulated by an action upon the world to see what changes that action makes. So, for example, we take certain fields of science. Let's take medicine and antibiotics. Now, antibiotics are something, first of all, done in very carefully restricted experiments. They were found very useful, and so they were spread over the social world, so that almost everybody has had antibiotics by now. But the problem now arises is this, that the people as we studied them before they ever had antibiotics were different from the people we are studying now who've had them. But what we knew about people before antibiotics has a little less value. We've got to restudy them every time because we've changed them. And the insects, you see, or the germs, also adapt to this. They say, you know, these human beings throwing down all this jazz and confusing us and killing us off, we got to do something about that. And so they change themselves, so they have to be studied again to know how to attack them the next time. Once upon a time, a spaceship arrived on a strange planet. And they came down, didn't seem to be anything living on it. And they put a lot of stores in. And finally they found that some little bugs were eating the grain that they had stored. So they got insecticides and fixed those bugs. And later they found they had mice. And they were nibbling up things, so they got some cats sent on the next spaceship from Earth. And the cats took care of the mice. Then, lo and behold, dogs turned up, started making trouble for the cats. So they decided that they'd better shoot the dogs. And they did. And one day they saw suddenly a man coming over the horizon with a gun. And they said to the chief, look at that, there are people on this planet after all, and he's got a gun, shall we shoot him? And he said, no, because I have no way of knowing what it will turn up as the next time. Well, now look here. What I've been trying to show is that you cannot use the language of illusion, that is to say, the language of accurate, separative description, too far without getting into confusion. Push your nominalism and it becomes realism. Push your scientific materialism and it turns into mysticism. I love doing this. I've had great fun. I gave a lecture at Harvard some time ago on B.F. Skinner. And B.F. Skinner is the arch behaviorist. He is Mr. Mechanist Psychology. And I took many, many passages from his works and said, now just see what he's really saying is so and so and so and so. He's a mystic. He really believes in the unity of the universe and all that jazz, you see, that the individual organism is a function of the cosmos. And if I say that, you see, I say he's a mystic, does this ruin his scientific reputation? What does it do? But that's, you see, that's the great game to play. Just push it along its logical line. And you arrive up in that predicament. One way or the other, and it really doesn't matter which way you do it. You either show that nothing exists at all on their terms, or else that it's all one. So, in this way then, we have to resolve the problem of mind and matter by what I referred to this morning as looking at these as dimensions of each other, or as different languages for talking about the behavior of the same thing. What the thing is that's doing this behavior, or the behavior is that has no thing doing it, really no one can say. And you can't say what it is, for exactly the same reason that you cannot touch the tip of this finger with this finger. To the tip of this finger is always inaccessible to its own touch, you see. And that's the problem of every nerve end. The nerve end can tickle another nerve end and say, hi, are you there? Am I here? And it says, yes, you're here. Oh. But it needs another to do it. Now, the whole universe hasn't got another to rub itself against. So it can't define itself. So the basic self in you can't define itself. That's why the highest attainment in Zen is no attainment. Why, no, it involves no idea. Why, Buddha, when he talked in the Diamond Sutra to Subhuti, says, Subhuti, when I attained complete and unexcelled awakening, I didn't attain anything at all. But you can see, I think, that this nothing at all is a statement of the same kind as when a logical positivist says, in making your metaphysical assertion, you said nothing at all. And if you are Zen, you say, correct. I entirely agree with you. And yet, you see, that nothing at all was all in all. That was the thing. That was the big thing. You know, you lost everything and gained everything in one fell swoop, as having nothing but possessing all things. Because obviously, you see, if the mirror weren't there, the images wouldn't be. And there'd be no connection between them. They couldn't jostle together.
if the water weren't there, how would the fishes get around? If the air weren't there, how would the birds fly? If consciousness weren't there, how would experiences occur? You see? If being weren't there, how could there be beings? So there are in Buddhist philosophy what are called the four inconceivables. Water to the fish, air to the bird, consciousness to man, and enlightenment to the ignorant. That is to say, to the ignorant in the sense that melody is inconceivable to the tone-deaf person, in the same way that color is inconceivable to the blind man, sound to the deaf man.
Thanks for tuning into this program from Better Listen. Please visit betterlisten.com for more information about this program and the opportunity to share your comments and feedback with others. Better Listen presents Reality, Art, and Illusion, Part 3 with Alan Watts.
Yesterday afternoon, I was discussing the plausibility of two essential features of the philosophy of illusion. The question that we have to decide whether to take life seriously or not, that is to say, whether the plot is comic or tragic. And if it's tragic, you see, must we say that it's ultimately tragic? And the question of who are you? And are we to say that I myself, right down at root, am just a little kind of jerk of some kind that really has nothing to do with this cosmos, but just arises in it and is here on sufferance for a short period, and then absolutely nothing follows, you see. Or the alternative to that is what I really am, the same as the whole thing, that is, the works, the it, or whatever you want to call it, Brahman, God, the Tao, the great void, the Buddha nature, I don't care, the self, anything, any name you want. And whereas that attitude, you can look at it from various points of view in judging it. You can say it's wishful thinking. You can say that it's insufferable pride. But the point of the matter is, as I tried to show, any other way of looking at things is kind of schizoid. It looks at human beings as if they arrived in this world like a bunch of birds on the branches of a barren tree. And they just got settled there, you know, and they don't belong. The sense of being strangers and pilgrims from another domain altogether. Well, where is this other domain? And how does it relate to this one? Are they separate? I showed you that even when we say that two domains are the poles apart, the very fact that they're poles shows that they have a hidden connection. And the hidden connection is the big thing in life. All you junkies know that. So, in other words, we get a pattern of organization that is radial rather than an assemblage, as if the universe were really a multiverse. A lot of things that got collected together out of the infinite wastes of space and sort of began to maunder around each other. Whereas the other pattern, which is so much more sensible, is central and radial, and I showed you how the crystals and the stars and the octopuses and even the human beings are all radial structures. Of course, we don't see our radial relationship to the totality of the universe because it isn't obvious. It's obvious that a tree
is an arm of the earth reaching up and waving at the sky. And a mountain is another kind of radiation from the earth. And so is a leg from a body, and hair, and things like that. But what makes human beings, as the highest of the mammals, so conscious of being independent is that they are topologically an enclosed surface, you see, which wanders around independently of the ground. What we don't notice is that we are not independent of the ground at all, that wandering around is something that is entirely related to there being some ground. In other words, when you run up a hill, the hill also runs you up it. The hill rises and lifts you as you run, you see? And if you understand that, you don't take a hostile attitude to mountains and hills. You're grateful to them for lifting you up so high in the air, because that's presumably why you